Hello and welcome to this week's episode of your favorite D&D and RPG themed podcast, Mastering Dungeons. I'm Sean Merwin here with Teos, not in the dark, Abadia.
I am not in the totality. I'm in the,
yes.
I don't know, in the absence,
in the absence of darkness.
Yeah, sure.
Can that be
on the bright side of the moon?
Yeah, there you go. There you go. I am in the path of totality here. And we record at 1 p.m. Eastern time. And by 3 p.m. Eastern time, it will be getting very dark around here. So we are going to get through this so I can run outside and stare at the cloudy sky for 6 minutes or however long that it's totally dark. And then I'll come back inside and record another podcast. Yay!
Huzzah.
But we have some things to get to, non-eclipse things to get to this week. First, in our listener corner, we have Kurt Ugle 4576 via YouTube, who asks, how much of your game prep, story, and elements tend to make it into play? How much do you improvise to suit a scene? Can you please talk about how to keep from getting frustrated when parts of your game prep don't get used? And how to not get too locked into your own expectations. I have learned to expect that none of my ideas are truly set in stone until they make it into play. But if I run multiple sessions in a locale, I may get a chance to try again. And players do love callbacks. And this is just a massive question.
That's
because
cool.
Certain people, aka Mike Shea, aka tons of people have talked about game prep, right? There's never unprepared, and books like that as well. And so it's a huge topic about how to prep, how to use the prep that you do. And so I have a few tips, but I'm not the best person to talk about this because for the most part in my games, I either am playing something I already wrote for a play test for a published thing, or running a published thing that someone else created, or I just take a vague idea that I have and I improvise on purpose. So I don't prep because I want to see how it comes out. So before I get into the things that came to my mind, Teos, is there anything that you wanted to say in general about this topic?
I mean, probably the thing I'd say the most that kind of, I think, answers all of these things is run other games. Because non-D&D RPGs have very different senses of how structured or not scenes are. And my impression, for what it's worth, is that as I have opened up my D&D games to where there's more possibilities, that's where things go off the rails, if you will. But I mean, that's what I wanted. So it's not really off the rails, right? But they go out into, they diverge from any one thing you might expect. And they surprise you. And that's great. But it means that whatever you prep may get not used. And so like we laugh about how during Tomb of Annihilation, I had this tavern thing that I was going to run that I was actually playtesting because it was part of Jungle Treks that I wrote with Eric Menge. So I was playtesting and I was so excited. And I had this like 3D tavern and that was sitting over there on the side. And that showed up like three times before we finally got to use it because they just weren't going back to town like I thought they would. And so that can happen when you have this thing that you want to drop in, but other things keep coming up, but that's not bad. That's good, right? As long as you're okay with the other part of it, which is, well, whatever they chose to do is improvisational and fun, and so you're just going along with it. I'd contrast that with a game like Blade Runner, where I just finished running the first session of the second box set. Really good, really fun. And it feels really open in terms of play, in that a scene is clues and the players, or an NPC and the players, and what exactly we say to each other, I don't know what's going to happen. And so it's very improvisational, but the location and the prep is 100% in that I know they will go to most of these locations and there's not that much to prep. And so I just know the NPC, or I know the clues, and then the rest is riffing, right? So the more you kind of play other games, the better you get at handling those kinds of different situations, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, my first thought is, it can help you not be frustrated if your prep doesn't get used, if you enjoy preparing for its own joy, right? It's fun to think of options, and it's fun to, for some people, to build worlds or build stories that may never be used, but you have done something cool in doing just that. Along the lines of what Teos just said, prepare for the chaos rather than preparing for a specific plot. So sometimes we sit down and we're like, okay, they're going to do this encounter, then this encounter, then this encounter, and we want to make those encounters perfect. But what we should be doing is, if they do something like this, this is what I will use. If they do something like this, this is what I can use. So rather than trying to choreograph, build tools, not statues. Right? Build the things that you will use, not the final version of what you think it should look like.
Ooh, that's great. I like that.
Yeah, there's a in Dungeon World, there is a move, a DM move called exploit your prep. And that's generally what it means. It means be prepared for contingencies, not for specifics. If you do a lot of prep and you want your game to move in a specific direction, you can learn how your prep was used in real life. So as you experience these things, you can go, oh, every time I prep something like this, it never gets used. So I'm going to stop doing that. And what I really need is a chart of names, or what I really need is a list of monsters that might be found in this area. So
That's
point your
smart.
prep in the right direction.
Yeah, that's really smart. And that's a great concept to review where you're going off the rails and whether, I mean, if it impacts you, right? And like I was perfectly fine with just having my terrain sit over on the side and my notes for that encounter. And whenever I got to it, I was fine, right? In the particular example I was giving of the tavern. But there are times when you can really feel like you want a particular set piece encounter to happen. And the truth is, like, if you're gonna do that, right? Like if when I set up like an enormous dwarven forge, you know, red dragon at the end and pits and stuff, and it took me a whole bunch of time to work that, we're going there. I'm forcing the issue. I mean, that's what's on the table. That's what's going on. And it's not about the choice. There'll be plenty of choice in other times, but we're going there. You know, but so you kind of want to know how flexible you want it to be and then adjust your prep accordingly based on what you're learning from all your sessions and your players, how much they zig and zag, why they zig and zag.
And that's the final point, which is, what expectations have you created with your players? Have you not trained them, but that's one way to think of it, is do they understand that you have prepared this stuff, so you want to do this, and they're okay with that? Then they're okay with you saying, I know that you want to go visit this, but I've really planned for this. Is everyone okay if we do that? There's nothing wrong with that for most players. Now, if you pride yourself on being someone who lets the players do anything that they want, then that's harder for you to do when it becomes very important to do. So, managing those expectations, what's fun for the players, but also what's fun for you, is showing off this terrain that you bought and put together over several days of work. Is it important that you visit that? And if it is, then visit that, like Teo said. So great question. A second question comes in from PT McKim via email. Email, is that stuff still around? Apparently. He says, I was fascinated by your discussion of exhaustion and hit points. I recently read some of Scott Fitzgerald Gray's Core 20 system blogs, and he mentioned his critical points concept is based on his old 5e homebrew of having critical points based on con, your constitution score. And there's a link in our notes to that blog. Since then, I've been playing around with that kind of grittier hit point crit system in which your actual con score is the serious physical damage that you can take on a critical hit or when hit points go to zero. As it goes down, your max hit point and con saves also go down. It's making it harder to restore hit points that add further gritty realism. Have either of you ever used a system like this? Teos, I will defer to you for the first part of this answer. Have you ever used a system like that?
Yes, sort of, in that at times I've wanted things to be based on how good you are. And seldom do I keep those systems for long because I find it feels strange to the players that, for example, the high constitution fighter took more damage than the wizard. And it becomes sort of strange. It's both strange, and the things that players will do about it will then depend, because the fighter might say, well, that's too big of value for me to do much about. Whereas the wizard might say, I can easily do X and now I'm protected, or, you know, mm-hmm. I've somehow made up for it because my number was smaller because it's based on me being weaker. So there's some danger with those things. And when I've used them, I've seldom stuck with it. All right, let's say I've never stuck with it, really.
Yeah. So to explain what Scott's system is, and I read it, I tried to absorb it. It's not difficult. It's just I've got 10,000 mm-hmm. things going on in my head. But what Scott's system does is it takes hit points and it breaks them down into two categories. You have critical points, which are the important ones, and then defense points. So defense points are the first things that go. This is the idea that when you take hit points of damage in D&D, you are actually not necessarily taking physical damage, but getting tired and defending yourself and taking blows that don't really leave wounds. Whereas the other half of hit points, the critical points, are the ones that show, yes, you are actually taking physical wounds, you are taking damage of a kind. And when you do that, what you can do is you can have not just a two-tiered system, but you can manipulate that two-tiered system. So you can say certain damage, like a critical hit, goes directly to your critical points rather than that hit point. So it's sort of a buffer with your defense points, and then the critical points are the real stuff. And you can play around, and you could do things like I just said, critical hits will do critical damage. Certain poisons might do critical damage and avoid your defense points. So you could still have 20 defense points, but those critical points, when they hit zero, then you're in trouble.
Yep.
And so that's the system. I like it in theory, but I would have to play around with it because it's not just that. It's not just the points, but it's everything that goes into hit points. It's the, when do you get them back? It's how quickly do you get them back? It's what are the consequences of losing one versus losing another? The simplicity of the normal D&D hit point system makes it very hard to replace, because people are so used to it that keeping track of one thing is hard enough for some people. Keeping track of two things that sort of mean the same thing can add a cognitive load to certain players that they don't like. To other players, they might want four, right? You have your temporary hit points and you have your this, and maybe you have the last one might be like your universal power, right? And maybe you only get two of those, and once one of them's gone, it never comes back, right? You could do lots of things and then have lots of interactions with those. The question is, what does it add to the game? And are players willing to go to that distance to get whatever it does add to the game?
This makes me, you know, Scott mentions Star Wars D20 in his blog, and it made, but what I actually kind of thought of in what you're just saying is Star Wars Saga, which had, I think it was called the condition track. I'm not entirely sure, but it, you know, you had your hit points and then you had this track, and the track was meant to sort of capture things like other RPGs do, where it's not just the damage you took, but sort of how you've been worn down. But what happened was, I think that was like a, I don't know, four part system or something like that. Or maybe it had a zero and it could go up or down. I forget, but it only had so many steps, whereas hit points have a lot of hit points, right? A big pool of them. And what happens is that then when you now are creating a dual system where some things in the game tap into this other track, and they tend to just do like a point or so because you're trying to be careful not to do too much. But you're not watching it as carefully as the hit point dial, because that's like what 90% of your rules are addressing. So what happened in Saga was there were a number of ways you could just overwhelm the condition track beyond what the game expected and just automatically kill things, especially spaceships. And this was a problem when you could just, you know, absolutely shut something down because you are bypassing those hit points. And so it requires a lot of careful planning when you create a sort of auxiliary defense system, right? And the same true is same is true of any game. Like, you know, Blade Runner has resolve. And so if you're going to go and stress people too much, suddenly, oh, wow, well, they're down. What do we do now? Or they'll never go down because they did this thing and tapped into this feature. And so those it becomes a whole nother set of playtesting you have to do, which I know Scott will do. But it, when we're doing it in our home games, it becomes a lot harder.
Yeah. And it's the reason why having monsters that damage ability scores is problematic. Ninth level characters this weekend. Ninth level characters fighting a couple of vampire spawn. Okay, they can handle that. But out of the alleyways come just a couple of shadows, right? Come up behind where the wizard's in the back. Wizard doesn't see them coming. Oh, they have advantage. Oh, doop, doop, two hits. What's your strength? 8. Oh, if I roll double 4s, you ninth level character are dead because of 2 1/2 CR creatures.
Yeah.
And that's the sort of thing. Now, some people love that. Right?
Yep.
But for a game, that's not good. For the mechanics of a game, that's not good. So you have to be careful, exactly like Teos was talking about, of making the system work on a large scale.
It's worth saying it's super fun to do these things. So, like, you know, as long as you're in a campaign where players are going to be fun and kind and they're going to work with you, try out a system like this and then say, oh, look, you know what? There was a total eclipse today and everything goes back to normal. You know, just enjoy it.
Yeah. What one thing I like is I'm going to rave about the Fate system more than once today. The Fate system has something called consequences. So you take damage, you take shifts, they're called shifts of stress. And so if you take 5 shifts of stress, that's a lot. And you don't have hit points, but you have ways to soak up that stress. And one of the ways is called consequences. So you take 4 points of damage, of stress. You could say, I'm going to use my 4-point consequence box. Check that off. And now I'm going to write something that's true about my character because of this damage. Oh, the giant just hit me with its Warhammer. Now I'm going to have the consequence of concussion. That's now an aspect in the game that can be used against me or for me if it happens to work out that way. So something like that is fun and it adds to the game as long as it fits into the mechanics, totality of the mechanics. That's just one way that the one thing that came to mind as I was thinking about this.
That's cool. Yeah, so it's a great
thank you.
Yeah, it's a fun question. I really dig it. And systems like that are really fun to play with. And I think the more, if you want to get into system and game design, you want to play with things like this in your game and try things out, see why they work, how they work, and when they don't, and why they don't.
Right. One question you want to ask is, do you want the characters to always be getting stronger? Because right now in D&D, that's what happens. You take hit points, you take various kinds of damage, but it always goes away. And as the campaign continues, you're always getting stronger.
Yeah.
Do you want a kind of a campaign where at some point that you may have a block of points that don't get stronger? In fact, you can never replace these 5 life points that somehow at some point may get down, go down, go down until you're at 20th level. But you've only got 1 life point left. And you know that if that goes because of a spell or because of whatever your system does, that that's the end of that character. Right. Now, that could be fun, but that flies in the face of everything that D&D is.
And Keith Baker did that with Phoenix Dawn Command, right? Where he said, you have a certain number of times you can die. And dying actually accomplishes a lot of things, does these really cool things. So you kind of will at times want to die, especially when the game is made hard by the game master. You know, you will need to have some deaths, but you only have so many. So how do you want to go out? When do you want to go out? And that becomes a fun part of it. You're not getting more of those. It's always going down, no matter how good your character gets over time.
So, great game design question, something to think on across all the games that we know and love. Speaking of things that we know and love, let's get into our news and commentary section, starting with live D&D at Madison Square Garden.
What?
What? Yes, Dimension 20 is going to do it. They have the actual play of Dimension 20, famously DM'd by Brennan Lee Mulligan. They will be playing a session at Madison Square Garden on the 24th of January, 2025. You can get your tickets by the time you hear this with the code word gauntlet at livenation.com. We've already seen Critical Role fill up a stadium in the UK, so why not bring it to the US with a with Brennan Lee and his crew?
That's pretty impressive, right? I mean, we saw how Critical Role did it, seeing Dimension 20 do this. I mean, Madison Square Garden, right? Like, okay.
Yeah. Now, is that the whole Madison Square Garden, or is it like a section? Do we know?
I thought there was no way that Critical was filling the whole of a stadium in the UK, and apparently they did from all the pictures, so we'll have to wait and see how that looks, but yeah.
Okay. Because there's what we talked about this before. There's Wembley Stadium and Wembley Arena, and there's the stadium is the whole thing where the arena is just certain amount. So
Right.
we'll keep an eye on this and
Yeah,
we'll
you'll have
see
to see.
how many people attend to see a
Yeah.
live Dimension 20 game.
It is just one night, but I mean, either way, that's amazing, right? Like this is not the, Holiday Inn that we're filling a banquet room, which I
This.
know my live play would not fill. So it's
It's
all
true.
win.
Well, we'd be lucky to get 50 people. So here we go. Was a challenge accepted. Speaking from filling an arena to filling your nightmares, Rob Schwalb was on La Taverna de Rol,
Perfect.
which means what?
The role-playing tavern, La Taberna de
Okay.
Rol. And this is a great interview. I mean, you and I, we love Rob Schwab. We've had him on the show. And he comes onto La Taberna de Rol, which that YouTube, I've been on it, but far greater people have been on it. And they've said some really neat things. Like they have a knack, I think, of asking questions that really give the person space to just chat. And so they end up sharing things that you haven't heard in other places. And this time it's Rob doing this on the interview. And he talks about, of course, Shadow the Demon Lord and Weird Wizard, his game that just is coming out now. But he goes back and talks about the history of 5e's creation and what it was like on the teams. Because the teams change, that's one of the big points he makes is, this team changes leadership. It goes from being from this person to that person to the other person, and that involves change. He talks about really fun things like Rob and Rodney Thompson go into a room and they just hammer out the proficiency bonus, and then they hammer out monster math. Right? One weekend, Chris Perkins goes off, doesn't tell anybody, just takes that monster math and creates a spreadsheet with the basic stats for every single monster in the monster manual. Just kind of like he went off and created Curse of Strahd. Like just you just go off and do it and comes back and goes, here's this, right? Rob shares some really neat insights into what the core concept of 5e was. And I love this so much, right? Because we heard about the modules, right? Like the idea that D&D Next was going to be modular. And if you like 4e, it'll be like this, or if you like, basic, it'll be like this. And they worked along those lines, right? And so their idea was that the basic character class for 5e would function like a D&D basic or even original D&D character. Then modules would allow more options. So the design of things in 5e, like your feats, your backgrounds, your subclasses, those were all originally envisioned as this sort of modular concept. But that proved to be hard to implement, so it ended up being a single approach with some things like feats being optional. But I love that because it shows how even when they strayed from their full intent, right, of making these modules, the goal of making a game that was accessible to everybody, and he talks about that earlier, that was met because they had such clear goals in mind, right? So the game retains that simplicity of its design because at the core it is like D&D basic. And then you have all these other pieces that are additional, but they're not intruding. They feel complementary and additive, and you can grasp the one and then go on to grasp the next. I thought that was all fantastic.
And that's goes to our Shadow Dark discussion, right? That's why Shadow Dark is something that could be made on the bones of 5e. It feels simple, it feels like basic D&D, but it still works mathematically because of that foundation.
Yeah, great point. Yeah, and Rob talks about bounded accuracy, and he talks about sort of how it came up. Like apparently Mike Merles like had this in mind very early on. He says, we were at Winter Fantasy in a hallway talk, and he was sharing this with me, what he thought it would how it would work. And he shares Rob shares kind of what he likes and doesn't like about bounded accuracy. What are the problems in system design, RPG design, when you have this, and what are the benefits, right? There's some really great benefits, but then there's some problems. So the whole interview is just fascinating. I love it. And he also shares his particular view on being part of a team like this, right? Like how does it feel to be on this team? Is it fun? Is it good? And he ends up kind of saying it's not for me, which I think is really interesting, right? But he's thankful for having been through the experience. So it's a great lesson. I highly recommend it.
Yeah. We've heard people on the team or near the team talking about sort of these questions, sort of the more gossipy things, right? Personalities and so on. But for me, it's I want to hear what were the other options and what are some benefits or drawbacks of the choices that were made or weren't made. So yeah, this is definitely something that would be right up my alley. We go now to Chris Bissett, who wrote about encounter tables. Chris ha he has his brand called Loot the Room, and talks about how someone claimed that random encounters were exactly the same as the quantum ogre. So what?
Quantum ogre is this idea that if you go left or right on the trail, either way, there's an ogre, right? The ogre is gonna appear, and there's no real choice. And so this idea of this sort of the random encounters wouldn't really provide you with any real choice.
And this quantum ogre trope is used as a curse. It's used as a negative thing, which it doesn't have to be. We've already talked about how do you exploit your prop, right? So it's not necessarily wrong as the game master to use a quantum ogre, depending on what the story and your players and everything. So, calling encounter tables. I'm not a big fan of encounter tables. I think we've talked about this before, but I understand where their value is. And so Chris sort of shows how random tables are not quantum ogre, and they're in fact quite the opposite, right? The quantum ogre is you go left, you go right, the ogre's there. This shows just a very simple chart, for example, of 1d6 encountering on a 1 to 3, 2d6 goblins that are hunting bears, on a 4 or 5, an injured bear, and on 6, Roland, the king of the bears, traveling with 1d6 armored bear retainers that are hunting goblins.
Great.
And so this each of those, first of all, will it happen? You don't know. It depends on what you roll to see if there was an encounter.
And it's
And
obviously a
then
very different story experience, right?
totally different experience, even within the same entry. Because if you roll a 1 to 3, that's 2d6 goblins hunting bears. If you're a first level party, even if you're a fifth level party, there's a huge difference between 2 goblins hunting bears and 12 goblins hunting bears. One of them, in one direction, it could be a role playing encounter. For either side, right? If it could be for 3 first-level characters, 12 goblins are going to not be easy. For a fifth-level party with 6 players, 2 goblins are nothing. So that could easily turn into a role-playing encounter where you, as the game master, say, what would these 2 goblins do versus what would these 12 goblins do? And then, of course, Roland, King of the Bears, with 1d6 armored bear retainers hunting goblins is a whole other thing. So in that case, reactions, surprise, starting distance, all of that makes for a very different encounter, even with the same very short, very small table.
Yeah, it's a really fun write-up and a really nice exploration of both the topic and then just also of what an encounter table can be like to be so story rich yet totally different. And what I love about this is you don't actually need any text here to tell me what's going on. The encounter table alone actually tells me a great story that I can build upon. No matter what result I get, I can play off of it. And that's such genius. Like, I really love this because I don't like encounter tables either. We've talked about this. Not that I never use them, but I generally don't love them. Because I always like a good story. And here, this is one I can sign off on because I know what's happening. And I can play off of it in a neat way. It really does actually do for me what a lot of people say counter tables should do for you. And here I feel it. And I just love that concept of, yeah, like, when you actually think about this encounter table, even when I get an injured bear twice in a row, the reactions, the starting distance, the whether it's there's surprise, this all does add to variability. And it could actually still be interesting to have two injured bears in a row, especially because you know as DM what's going on. So you can play off of that. One of them might be injured in a trap. One of them's got a spear sticking inside, right? So those two things can be very different and cause the players to really get interested in all of what's going on. It's great.
Yeah, I mean, the difference between a bear with one hit point left lying on the ground versus a very large and angry bear with only one hit point gone, is a
Yeah.
completely different story.
Wow.
So, and it shows, it shows the care that you can take to create these things and the utility of them if they are done well, as opposed to just 1d4 orcs, 1d4 ogres, 1d4 ghouls, right? And
Yeah.
that's it.
This is really one of my all-time favorite encounter tables that I've seen in the last few years. And we also talked about when we looked at Rime of the Frostmaiden, and they had that interesting system where based on the dice you're rolling, you were reflecting the probability that they were in a avalanche or sort of storm, ice storm conditions. And I thought that was super clever design too, where one roll is really telling you two things, and that was really neat as well. And that the both those ideas, these ideas are great to steal and use as DM.
Let's go to our creator and crowdfunding corner. We're going to start with Jeff Stevens and his product Infestation at Devil's Glade for 5e. Tell us about this, Teos.
Yeah, the town of Devil's Glade is under attack. There are swarming insects that have driven the residents out of their homes and businesses. Giant insects patrol the town square. It's worth them when the eclipse is going through your town. Who or what has brought these creepy crawlies to Devil's Glade? And of course, this is a Jeff Stevens adventure. It isn't just that there's some infestation. There is more going on behind the scenes. The why of it is fun. And so your players will enjoy unraveling that mystery. It's a 2 to 4 hour adventure designed for 4 to 5 characters of first to fourth level, optimized for level 3. There are scaling suggestions, so you can play it even all the way to fifth to sixth level. It sounds really fun. Take a look at the Kickstarter page. Infestation at Devil's Glade will take you there if you search for it, or we have it in our show notes. And Sean, what do we think about Jeff?
I love Jeff. And Jeff made a big announcement recently that he has quit his day job and has become a full-time RPG publisher. So, congratulations, condolences, and good luck, Jeff. We're on your side, in your corner, and we hope it goes swimmingly. We also have a Fantasy Age 2E free quick start from Green Ronin. You can get that new free quick start at their store at greenronin.com or on DriveThruRPG.
I always love their quick starts. They're really nicely done. If you're ever curious, like, what should a good quick start look like, they often have really nice ones. And it's a great way to see, like, what is this game like and what could I learn from it? So check it out and you'll see kind of all that drives Fantasy Age as a unique RPG fantasy system.
And last but not least, there are times when I'll see something and I'll go running to the show notes to add it. to see Teos either has already done so or is in the process of doing so. And that
And vice
happened
versa.
today with this. Ethan Yen asks, what if you did it all with just hit dice? So Ethan is a supporter of our show, and maybe missed the April Fool's window with this simple one-page game that he has up on itch.io. So you take this,
Yeah,
Teos.
sure.
Tell
I mean,
us
so
what he
he just
says.
he asks this question, right? What if hit, well, he says, I think hit dice are underutilized in D&D. What would happen if the game was just hit dice? Oops, all hit dice. And he makes a one-page RPG out of this concept that you can take the rules and fold it up to build a dice tray or set it into your dice tray, and look at the rules while you roll in the dice tray. Because what you're going to do is players and DMs are going to throw dice into this dice tray, and it's in fact intended that you will chaotically, smash into each other's dice, changing the values so that there's oh no's and yays as you do this. The values are going to get compared, and this is going to result in foes or PCs being eliminated or taking damage, depending on how many hit die they have. When you win and when you beat an encounter, you are going to each PC is going to get a hit die. And PCs get to choose classes. Classes have slightly different hit die sizes and hit die benefits. So the wizard can kind of cast spells based on what hit die is rolled, and the cleric can choose when to roll. And there's some different fun things like that. It's a fun read. I don't know to what extent Ethan has, super made this into a fully fledged play tested game, but as a creative idea and something fun that you can just click on and check out, you should totally do that.
Yeah, I haven't gotten a chance to read it all the way through, but I saw the concept. I'm like, okay, this is cool.
It's really cool. Yeah, it's fun.
I could see this turning really ugly really fast with some groups as dice are thrown at 200 miles an hour
Want to see if he
into the
drops
dice
this
tray.
into one of his 5e adventures. He's written some really fun adventures, and if he throws
Yeah.
this in there, that's the kind of thing the players go, wait, what are we doing? You're reduced to
You
only your
can
hit
check.
dice.
You can check that out at Ethan Yen, Yen, dot itch.io slash hit dash die. And all other of Ethan's stuff will be there as well. So that is our news on this eclipse day. Now we're going to get into our main topic today, which we took from our listeners' suggestions, as well as something that we also wanted to talk about and made it into its very own topic, which is designing player options into new campaigns. So, if you go back a few weeks, we've talked about world building, we've talked about creating a starting location for your campaign, we talked about starting new or creating starting adventures for your new campaign. So now we want to talk about the players and their interaction with your new campaign. How do you create or leverage player-facing rules that will intrigue your players while also grounding them in your new world, your new setting, and your new campaign? Also, how do you give them meaningful, informed choices early in the campaign to make them feel like a part of the story? And when is it the best to give those options, or when is it best not to? We're going to get into all of that today with this talk.
I like
So
it.
we'll start. Yeah, we'll start with new rules or limiting rules for your campaign. I'm going to step back here. I'm right in the middle of doing this for a lot of different things. I'm doing it for Crooked Moon. A bit. I'm doing it for Surviving Strange Hollow. I'm doing it for Grim Hollow and for other stuff at Ghostfire Gaming. So this has been hitting me from all directions. Taking a standard rule set like 5e and bringing parts to it or taking parts of it away in order to create an experience that the players will enjoy and creating an experience that's different from the base game. So that's sort of where we're looking at it. And then we're going to add in that idea of choices in the adventure as well as choices in the campaign. Is there any overview you want to talk about before we delve into these individual questions and topics?
I mean, just that I would say that at the high level, it's amazing how powerful this can be, because it allows us to tell a particular type of story by focusing the players from the very beginning on where they, an area where they're going to have more say, more power, more capability. So you're kind of focusing the play for them. And that can be everything from character options they're choosing that then push off of a particular theme, or it can be a subsystem you're introducing. All of that is really powerful. It's surprising, like, shocking to me when I first got into doing this, how much it changed things, right? Because it's one thing to come up with a theme for your campaign. It's another to then have something that suddenly the players go like, oh yeah, great. Okay, I'll do that. That sounds great.
I've heard game masters, DMs say, we've played D&D. My group has played D&D for 20 years or 10 years or 5 years. And I want to run a campaign of blank, Alien, right? Mm-hmm. All the games that we've talked about. But they just can't grasp it. Their mind is too steeped in D&D. Doing something like this can be a middle step. It can leave them enough of the base game to still understand it while moving away to a point where they can accept it more.
Yeah.
So it can be a middle step between moving from D&D straight into another game, sort of a half step. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but it's something that I've noticed can be helpful with the right group.
Yeah, for sure.
So the first question that you need to ask when you do this is the D&D campaign you're running meant to be the base experience, or are you attempting to create a slightly different experience with this new campaign that you're running? And if it's going to be a new experience, even if you're changing rules slightly, even if you're doing the new hit point system that we talked about in the previous segment, you need to be upfront with the players about that. They have to understand, especially if they're steeped in just the basic rules or the base rules, that, hey, we're going to try these different things. And you need to manage those expectations. Are they willing to step outside their comfort zone in this? Are you willing to help them step outside their comfort zone in this?
Right, right.
It takes a lot of communication outside of the game to get everyone in on the same page and in the same mindset.
And especially based on the degrees you're going to pursue this idea, right? So like we could say, I'm going to run a horror campaign. Okay. You know, that can just be themes. It may not need a whole lot of anything for player buy-in and for it to feel good for you to enjoy it. But if we then take it a step further and go the Ravenloft route and say, like, the first thing you will do is you will draw a card. You know, Madame Eva is going to present you with this option, and that's going to really drive play in various ways. But then we could lean in it further, and we could say the Taroka deck is not just driving some, you know, a few things in the story to customize it, but this card is going to keep on mattering to you. And in fact, you will get some benefits off of the card you choose. And some of them you'll unlock over time, right? By having those conversations, whatever that level is that we're going with the players, we start really focusing that play, and it creates interest, right? Oh yeah, what is my card going to be? You know, what will I uncover over time related to my fate that's been read to me? And then those are, right, great ways that you change a campaign when you lean in like that. Mm-hmm.
So if you are going to implement new rules or house rules or variant rules, or if you're going to pull a part of the system out that doesn't fit into this new campaign, new experience that you're trying to run, be clear and upfront with the players about the experience you're trying to create. There can be this part of you that wants to surprise. Ooh, they will be so surprised and pleased when I reveal to them that this thing that they've counted on will not be available to them. Oh, there's no magic items in this game. Or what have you. That doesn't tend to go well. Even if the immediate surprise is, oh, cool. Oh, this is going to be fun. then the reality begins to hit. So you want to do all of that work ahead of time. Explain in clear terms what you hope to do in the campaign. I want this to be a campaign where survival is the most important thing. So spells that give you food or water aren't going to be available.
Right.
Long rests are actually going to be a week instead of 24 hours, right?
Right.
Those sorts of things. Explain why you want to do it, what you think will happen because of it, and get them invested in that way, both
Yeah.
emotionally and mentally.
And the fun of it, right? Because if you tell me that there's,
Right.
long rests aren't happening often, I'm gonna be, well, are you telling me I'm gonna just be sort of playing in a torturous campaign where everything hurts, right? In one of my campaigns, I was talking about there would be a lot of traps, and a couple of them were like, eh, I don't know about that. I'm like, what if they're fun traps and, it's not because this is just painful? And they're like, oh, yeah, okay. And so then what I did is check in partway through. How are we doing on the number of traps? It's all great. Okay, good.
So explain that and be receptive to any feedback of those worries, right? I want to do this. Oh, I really don't like games where I'm never at full hit points, or I can never find an item that would be helpful.
Right.
And then you could say, all right, those are good concerns. Here's how I plan to address that. I'm going to put a rule in that says you go to back to full hit points blank. You still may not get a full rest, but you will be at full hit points. Or you can't buy these goods, but I've put a system in place where you can make them
Right. Yeah.
during a long rest, or right. And then so that helps address those fears, and it gives you good feedback on what you might need to put back in to the game that fits both your desire for the experience and the player's desires for the experience.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are games where sometimes these concepts have not quite worked, right? Like if I think of like defiling magic in Dark Sun, various editions have really struggled with this because the idea that casting magic destroys the planet but is powerful creates a sort of really rough set of choices that don't always translate to great play. And you have to really nail that carefully, or otherwise it ends up being, well, everybody just wants to be a desire and says my character doesn't care, or they're never casting because this is difficult, or yeah.
That's a great example for Aurora, not the published version, but the version that's in my head. At the beginning of a campaign, there is no arcane magic. But the moment that the Dragon Rage hits, the buffers that kept arcane magic from the humanoid masses go down.
Sure. Great.
So everyone is flooded with arcane magic, but there are no spells. You can't just go as a wizard and copy a spell. You have to unlock them. You have to find them. They were hidden away, right? Spell books were hidden away by dragons, or the sorcerer's power was hidden away in various relics and idols that you will then have to find. So as if you're going to play a wizard, you can't just go through the book and say, okay, I want this spell that, right? You have to, there might be a very, very small list, but you have to unlock these.
Yeah.
So is that going to be something that's okay with you, player who wants to play a wizard, right? I promise that you will always have access to spell slots and, at least cantrips and a fair number of spells, but you're not going to just be able to go into the book and when you level, pick
Right.
seven that you can just take. So that's a huge issue to get out there ahead of time. So that's the concepts that you need to keep in mind as you bring new rules in to your campaign or pull elements of it out. Coordinate with your players, make them or help them understand your reason for doing it, and try to help make that their reason for doing it as well. Then we get to new player-facing rules. So these are things that you might build or you might draw from other sources that aren't in the main game that will tailor the campaign to the environment, to the experience you're trying to create through player options.
This is really neat because what it does is from the very beginning says to the player, hey, what if you tailor your character to this campaign, right? Do you want to be the explorer type subclass of your class so that you fit into this Indiana Jones type campaign we're running? Do you want to have a particular deity and your cleric subclass that reflects the deities of this world and the particular one that you're going to follow. All of that creates a real buy-in from the player that they are going to really reflect the theme of the campaign, the campaign setting elements by doing it. So it's really fantastic. So it's a lot of fun. I have to say, I don't often do this of adding options. Though I certainly understand what it is, but I think it's a lot of time, and I tend to spend my time on sort of the story prep side of things rather than the player facing side. But what I will do is often fine tune and prune what options there are, and what I will often do is think through the available choices and say these will really resonate in our campaign, right? So essentially say if you pick this existing subclass, you are kind of doing what I would have done if I'd built, and I might play off of it more, right? But no additional mechanics will probably be coming in.
And one thing you can offset the things you've pulled out by adding these things. Yeah, I don't want you to use any of the Wizards of the Coast products other than the Player's Handbook, but we're going to bring in these three books that focus on horror. Use the subclasses from those books as a replacement. That will help you cut down on possible, right, overstimulus of too many choices, as well as some broken combinations that might
And
come
that's
out
really
about
nice.
that.
I think that basic options, like what's in the player's handbook, almost always works in any world, right? So I can be in Dragonlance and I can be just, any of those rogue subclasses, and it's generally going to work. What'll often happen is if you look at something like Intasha's, right? Oh, I'm this, sorcerer, but I'm spitting out tentacles, or I'm this, druid that bathes in fire and stuff. That might be too much, right? And that's where you want to think through what you want to approve or at least a modification process, an approval process, modification process. Like, hey, I'll work with you on any concept you have. Ideally, you stick to things that you know fit this campaign, based on the description I've given you. But if you want something else, let's talk, right? You want to be a Warforged in Greyhawk. You want to be a Gif or Hadouzi in Dark Sun, right? Like, maybe you need to talk about that, especially if you wanted to be like a Water Genasi. I think we're going to need to talk about what that means and whether we're going to do it in a fun way so that it is not just the, oh, you're strange every time in every scene and it gets old after a while. We'd want to come up with a reason it works and have the frank discussion of, is it just better that you do something that really embraces the comps that we're talking about?
One way to do it is you get all the skills, all the abilities of this species, but you just look human. Or what we did with Aurora and what will be in the Ethereal Expanse from Ghostfire is you build your own species from scratch every time you choose from these abilities. And that will help the player feel like they're building something unique while still fitting into the atmosphere of the experience of your campaign. Let's just cross out these seven choices because they don't fit, but choose from the rest of these and you can build your character any way you want. So we're going to put in front of our players player options that will hopefully be pleasing to them while at the same time fitting into the campaign. One of the best ways to do this is through backgrounds because they have the least impact in terms of mechanics while having a great impact on potential stories. You choose a background right now in fifth edition D&D, right? You get a couple of proficiencies, a couple of languages, some flaws can be associated with it, traits, bonds, etc. And then you get that one feature that we joke about being free room and board, right? No matter which one you choose, it's free room and board with this congregation, free room and board for criminals, free room and board for entertainers.
Someone gives you a sandwich for some reason.
Yes. Those are the places where you can add something a little bit more, not super powerful, not even mechanically powerful, but powerful in terms of being useful to the players in situations where they will find themselves.
Backgrounds are great because, but it takes the time. You've got to dedicate the time because a background is so much about the story, and the what makes backgrounds so easy is that mechanically they don't intrude much, right? Your proficiency and a few things and a feature, but the story really matters, and so you want to prepare to play off of that, right? Your story is that you are, from the underground miners. What does that mean to our campaign? And how will I make use of that? Because otherwise, it becomes like all the games that you don't super enjoy, the campaigns you don't super enjoy, where you don't even remember what the characters' backgrounds are, right? So there's no point in customizing it or fine-tuning it if you aren't going to play off of it. So you have to do that part of the work and be prepared for it.
And part of that work isn't just thinking about what it means in your particular setting. What is it going to mean in your campaign and in the adventures that deliver that campaign? So you may need to think ahead to, okay, in the middle part of this campaign, levels 5 through 8, they are going to be underground for the whole time. So that's where this mining background may come in. What are some challenges I could put in front of the players that if this character says, oh, but I am a miner, I would know that then you can reward the player for that without making it a cakewalk, without just hand waving 3 levels of saying, oh, you're a miner, well, you could do, but making it worthwhile. And then oh, the next is going to be on a cloud castle, and my background is something to do with the weather. And the weather is going to play an important part up on that cloud castle. So that's when they get to do their thing.
And of course, you can't let them drink because they're a minor.
That's very true. That's very true. I don't know where you grew up, Teos, but I'll tell you what.
Actually, I grew up in a place where it didn't matter what age you were, but
Exactly. As
I
long
was
as you
thinking
weren't a
about this,
minor.
like a lot of times RPGs that have really clear kind of you are this, that, and the other, we can borrow from that element, right? Element like are you the like in the game of Alien, right? Are you the colonial marine? Are you the person that's on the base that's the kind of settling that area? Are you the xenomorph expert? Are you the shipping person, right? The like whatever are you? And we could also stratify, right? You can say like, are you the lieutenant on the ship and the captain and that kind of thing, or are you the grunt that has to get the work done, right, or do the fights and what? Those kinds of things can be really easy to latch onto, and they help with role playing, right? Because you just automatically understand, okay, if I'm just the grunt marine, here's how I'm going to role play my character. But if I'm the captain of the ship with these different responsibilities and capabilities, I'm going to play a certain way. And so think through those backgrounds that you offer, that they aren't just setting pieces, but that they enable the role play experience, right? And that can be really useful to think through.
One of the hardest ways of bringing players into the game mechanically is through classes. Because classes are terribly, terribly difficult to create and balance well. But if they are done well and tested well and really fit a setting, they can be a great way. Right now, I am making a class called a Monster Hunter for Grim Hollow. And we've done an initial play test, very small play test. We're about to move into a wider play test for this new class, but it really fits this
Right.
Grim Hollow theme of there are monsters everywhere. The people are terrified. They have very little power over them, so they are going to call on monster hunters to do this. So it can work. If you want to design it yourself for your home game, great. There's no better way to play test it than to make it and give it to one of your players and let them have their fun, and you can see how it goes. But be ready to rebalance, be ready to rewrite at a moment's notice, because when things go wrong, they can go very, very wrong.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's thinking of things like the gunslinger, right? Like sometimes we feel like those things are a big part of the backstory, but a lot of times they end up feeling more like just a class, and it's harder to tie that into the background because it's so focused on what the one character is doing, and it can feel like it's too much if we play off of the class. But in other cases, it makes sense. Yeah.
Right. Monster Hunter works because there are guilds. The guilds are going to correspond to subclasses, and right they're a huge part of not just of the world, yes, but also of the rules that we have for things like salvaging monster parts. So they fit it that fits in so many ways. But you're absolutely right. I will see people come up with a subclass of something like that, gunslinger. And it's like, okay, well, where do gunslingers fit in the world? Is there some sort of do they have a code that they have to live by, like a paladin?
Like
It's
a
just
critical
I want
role,
my character to use a gun, so I'm
right?
going to have it this whole
And
class.
critical role has an explanation for, the why a character uses a gun. And it's a fun story and definitely a fun exploration, but that is a one person kind of unpack. Not that it doesn't fit into the setting, but it's one person's story, versus tying into the full setting. And I always like to compare against elegant things like, in 13th Age, you have these factions that are based on the icons. You have the icons, really. The icons function like factions, and they are both the things in the world and the things you are allied with, or that you have negative kind of enmity with, or that they are cautious about you. And that just drives play in so many ways without being just individual. I mean, they're individually based because you have your relationship with them, but they exist up here, right? And so you're constantly interacting with them. And another campaign could be all about the deities you're aligned with, right? And those things would work really easily. And it's elegant. It's nice.
So somewhere between backgrounds and classes or subclasses, they're a little bit easier to create. They're a little bit easier to balance. That you have lots of examples of each that you can pull pieces from to build your own. There is still the potential to make them a little too powerful, or sometimes worse, a little too underpowered compared to the other subclasses. So, use them. Use them with caution, but or make your own. But like with the classes, always be coming back to don't make them just for the mechanics, just for the power. Make them a part of your world. If a character chooses this subclass for your campaign, it should be because it gives them a space, a role in the world. And if you can do that, then you are building both an interesting, a fun thing for the players, but also a flavorful thing for the players. They become a part of your world rather than just becoming the random. I'm trying. Samurai always comes to mind for this for me, right? Because that's one of the subclasses in one of the splat books from Wizards, and I love the idea of it. I love some of the mechanics of it, but it just doesn't seem to fit in the worlds that they're building.
That's why I always reskin the Twilight Cleric into whatever concept I
There
come up with.
you go.
It eclipses everybody else.
Ah, I see what you just did there. I see what you just did there. And one thing that I try to stay away from for creating new things for my campaign rules wise, player facing rules wise, is feats. Unless it's a feat that ties to a new system I'm creating. So if I'm creating a system for very, very heavy gamified exploration, then I'm going to create feats that you can take that will tie into that system. So you may be giving up the feats that, you can do 10 extra points of damage around, but the feat that you would take in its place will become just as valuable in that new system that I'm pulling in.
Yeah, I tend to feel like it too often will struggle against those things, right? Where people, the third edition would do this. You'd see supplements that would say, oh, and their first feat, they can choose one of these campaign feats. And the player would be like, yeah, no, I need to work towards power attack. Sorry, I'm not doing that. I need to take mobility and I need to take dodge and I need to blah, blah, blah. Like, I'm not playing your game. And that's where it's unfortunate. The other thing is that feats feel like you're trying to arbitrarily say every character do X. And if that's what you want, then that's a subsystem, right? And you can do those things in flavorful ways without being powerful things that then don't have to trade off against powerful things. If it's not powerful, if it's more thematic and useful, utility-based, then you can just add it on top, right? Like with Acquisitions Incorporated, we gave these roles, right? To play off of in sort of a funny way, but also recognize, some people are like always the person who's writing down the party treasure. And what, who has what loot and what? All right, well, let's make them the horde person, right? And let's give them some things that actually help that role happen. And we'll tie it into this corporate setting to make it feel a little more like you've got like your job function at a workplace. And you're the leader, you're the decision maker. So you'll get a voting booth and a, or a coin to flip or whatever, and give out these things to all the different roles and enforce that so that it creates those sort of fun mechanics. None of it is groundbreaking or game breaking. So you can just play away to your heart's content as an extra thing that you get, and nothing's been, unbalanced. So that's good.
So that was topic two. Topic three is making the characters and the players of those characters feel involved quickly in your campaign. The question we had that triggered this was sort of like, how do you make consequential choices very early in intro adventures? And so I wanted to sort of morph that into this involvement in the campaign. And the easy answer is the first two things we just talked about, they are the way to bring the players into this immediately by giving them choices during character creation. But once the dice start rolling, once the DM starts reading that first box text, there are ways to make people feel involved quickly. But it's hard because with a new campaign, you want choices to be meaningful, but you can't have meaningful choices without information. Otherwise, it's the coin toss. I don't know whether we should go right or left because I don't know anything about what might be right or what might be left. So it's more important, rather than having these huge meaningful choices too soon in a campaign, to find a way to provide information that will make the choices that come soon as meaningful as possible.
Yeah, and this makes me think of Dragonlance, where one of the things that works really well about that setting is that you can early on sort of align yourself with different elements of the world through your choices. So if you are a wizard, well, what kind of wizard, right? What color robes do you wear? And that ties you into the setting, and you should know enough about those differences that you can get some pretty quick understanding of what it'll mean. And the fact that the story will probably play off of that choice. So that becomes a significant thing. I'm aligned with this, aspect of magic and this moon and so on. If I'm a more of a fighter type, then understanding that in this world, what that means is we're a world at war. So you're gonna probably care more about these nations and these rumors about armies and maybe you care specifically about like the Knights of Salamnia, or are you going more paladin? Are you going more fighter? That can play into different directions depending on what class you take. By thinking through all that and presenting that to the players with, as you said, enough of that information, it becomes a really big deal. Versus if you think otherwise, hey, I'm running Dragonlance. What character are you playing? Oh, I'm playing a wizard. Okay, well, now you got to choose this thing, right? Oh, okay, right, whatever. You're right. A fighter. Okay, great. You know, later I might tell you something why it matters. But if we do it up front, you can really get that buy-in in that intersection of the character choice and the story, the campaign setting.
Yeah, that's the next thing I was going to say was if players made choices during character creation, show the consequences during play.
Yeah, the consequences and the connections, right? Like in Dark Sun, if you're a halfling, what that, you know, what you're now a part of, right? The, the cannibals or the ancient remnants of society, right? Depending on what you might know about it. But you've got now a certain link. If you're a half giant, right? Here's your role in society. If you're a mole, if you're a human, if you're right. And same thing with class, that it has certain connotations in the world. Or if you did something like 4E's themes and you say, well, are you a gladiator or a noble or a merchant? Right. These carry really big parts of the setting with them, which is what makes them so exciting. And so if you can communicate enough about those options, then it becomes really interesting to the players. You know, I think I want to be tied to the merchants and I want to be kind of one of those merchant assassin bards. Right. Then all these classes, all these choices, and I'm an elf who formerly was part of this tribe that lived in this area. Now, all we've got a lot of setting going on with the characters if we tie in that way.
And one way to show that is to give the characters their own individual scenes early on, not an hour each, not even 15 minutes each, but just an interaction, right? You walk into town and you are the towering barbarian who wears the crest of their clan. What does that mean to people in this town? Show that right away. As they walk in, right? Someone runs when they see this person, obviously in fear of them. Maybe another person comes up and starts talking to them in their native language and says, Your people rescued me. I was an explorer. Mm-hmm. You rescued me. Thank you. Here, let me buy you a drink that is beloved by your people. It's very hard to get in town, but let me and establish that.
Yeah,
that can be through class, species, background. It can just be through personality traits, whatever personality traits you chose, right? Establish those, intertwine those into the story as soon as possible. Get all that information flowing. Then let's make those big choices matter later, even if it's in the same session later. Who are we going to back? The Thieves Guild or the necromantic cult or neither?
Yeah.
You need to see what all of that means.
And, you know, you can do this for most campaigns. Like if you really sit down and think before you bring this campaign to your players, you can think through and think, you know, like you could do it with Baldur's Gate, you know, and what parts of the city you're from, and ties into Elturel or something like that, ties to the paladins that are tied into the sun. You could look at something like Icewind Dale, right? You could say you're all going to be from a different 10 towns and I'm going to slightly adjust this campaign. So the real core theme is Icewind Dale's falling apart. Can it pull together? And can you do that? Can you unify the 10 towns, right? At a time when the rhyme is tearing it apart. And then you could say, okay, which towns do you all want to be from? And that could be a background angle, something that's added to your background or something like that, right? Some additional feature. All of that would create a lot of buy-in and interesting pieces, especially if you have to go to all the 10 towns and you, like you said, they're going to be these reactions, right? Oh, you're coming from that town that's, you know, ruled by the Zhentarim. I don't like you one bit. I'm trying to overthrow it. Well, maybe. Convince me.
Yeah. The final thing I would say is if you do have new systems or subsystems, get those involved as early as possible too. If there is a new gamification for exploration, start with an exploration scene. You are trying to find this lost town that's rumored to be up in the mountains and you need to find the trail to it. Do that right away. If you have a new hit point system that you're trying to get people used to, right? A four-tiered hit point system.
All hit die.
Start with a battle where you're taking away those various types of hit points, so they can see it in play.
Yeah, totally. That's great. And we often design these things that we think to ourselves like, oh, later when they reach fifth level, nah, get that stuff out there now. You can always add to it or modify it over time, but you want to get that out there and see if it even works or resonates. And don't be afraid to adjust it, right? And say, yeah, here comes the eclipse to change things.
Speaking of eclipse, we are going to be going into it pretty soon. So I am going to end everything here. Thank you so much, Teos, for
Thank you
bringing
all.
us into your new campaign here. And thank you to our patrons. And thank you to all our listeners. We've had a slight influx of patrons recently. So thank you so much. If you are out there listening and you enjoy this show and you come to us every week to hear what we have to say and to share our joy of role-playing games, you can become a patron too by going to patreon.com/masteringdnd. We have Master of the Realm supporters. Thank you. We have Master of Dungeon supporters. Thank you as well. Our Masters of the Multiverse, however, they get announced right here. Keith Ammon of The Monsters Know What They're Doing. Lou Anders of Lazy Wolf Studios. Craig Bailey, Steve Bissonette, Merrick Blackman, Evil John, Andy Edmonds at Nerdronomicon.com, Nathan Fuller, The Mighty Jerd, Ben Heisler and Paige Lightman, Sean Hurst, Chad Jackson, Brian King, Jim Klingler, aka DM Prime Mover, Chad Lynch, The Mathemagician, Eric Menge, John Mickey, Sean Molly, Falcon Neal, Tom Nelson of The Deck of Player Safety, Mike Olson, Mighty Zeus, Post Fiction RPG Audio, Robert Pasley, Vladimir Prenner from Croatia, Chance Russo at Drago Russo, Ross Sandberg, Andy Shockney, Krishna Simonse, Trace, Joe Tyler, James Walton, Graham Ward, Javier Wozniak, Chris Webster, and David Bastiansen. Thank you so much for your support. Again, you can support the show by going to patreon.com/masteringdnd. You can also help us out by subscribing via YouTube or leaving us a review on Apple Podcast or via whatever means you listen to this podcast. Teos, what you got going on and where can people find it?
Find me at alphastream.org. That's where everything is going down.
All right. And for me, you can follow me on all the socials at Sean Merwin. And you can follow the show itself on the socials at MasteringDnD. So we have begun our campaign by bringing in new player rules. What are we going to do now?
Eliminate immediately TPK all that party.
All of that character creation. Let's do it all again because it was so fun.
But better.
Yeah.